Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
It's 3 days of debate today on a proposed constitutional amendment banning gay marriage. Although the legislation probably won't pass, backers of the ban say it will force many lawmakers to clearly outline where they stand on same-sex marriage. President Bush started framing the discussion in his weekly radio address Saturday when he said the amendment will strike back at judges who overturn state laws prohibiting gay marriage. But Democrats say the debate is a waste of time and nothing more than a pre-midterm election appeal to social conservatives. Well, joining us with more is Linda Feldman. She's covering this story for the Christian Science Monitor. And Linda, in his weekly radio address, when the president strongly promoted this amendment, it was the first time he's done so since 2004. What do you think is going on behind the scenes here?
Well, the president has had a long, throughout his presidency, has had a long practice of taking positions that the religious right is happy with, but not really forcefully advocating for them, because he and his advisors are trying to create a big tent Republican Party and not just advocate for the positions of one wing of the party. So he holds the right positions from their perspective, but then he doesn't fight for them, so they're frustrated with him.
Well, and some say that this issue suddenly back on the front burner, along with other issues such as a ban on burning the flag, is a sign that Karl Rove is back on the scene, and these are the first visible contours of his electoral strategy.
Right, although, if you're looking at this from a purely electoral perspective, this could have the effect of endangering some of the most vulnerable Republicans in the House in particular. There are very few competitive races this fall, but with control of Congress so close, it could still flip to the Democrats if a lot of Republicans lose, and a lot of those are moderate Republicans based in the Northeast, where support for gay marriage is a lot stronger than in other parts of the country. So I'm not sure that highlighting this division within the party is really in the party's best interest.
Well, and what are some of the lawmakers who might be most affected by this debate?
Well, you have a couple of vulnerable Republicans in Connecticut, Chris Shays and Rob Simmons. You have some in New York, Sweeney. You have the two House members from New Hampshire could be affected. Those add up, even those there, add up to bring the Democrats closer to the 15-seat margin they need to close.
John McCain, we understand, would also be affected by this debate.
Absolutely. This is not just about 06. This is also about the 08 presidential race. John McCain has stated clearly he does not support a constitutional amendment banning gay marriage. He doesn't oppose same-sex. He doesn't support same-sex marriage, but he thinks it should be left up to the states. And he's worked hard to patch up relations with the religious right, but this could kind of highlight their differences again.
Well, and I'm wondering, this also comes as there is terrible news out of Iraq, several incidents being reported in Iraq, alleged incidents, and also big stories, like, for instance, there's going to be a hearing tomorrow on the way the FBI has been spying on journalists who publish classified information. Given sort of the big issue items that are on the table for the House, are any Republicans worried that this might be seen as a cynical attempt to just bring out the old issues that appeal to President Bush's core?
Well, this is a worry. These will be the issues of the week, gay marriage and flag burning, and then they will go away because it's likely to fail, and we'll get back to sort of the bigger, more fundamental issues, at least from the perspective of a majority of Americans. You look at polls and gay marriage ranks nowhere on the list of what are seen as the most important issues.
Yeah. In fact, I'm looking right now at some information. It says recent polls show that there's far less support for amending the Constitution to ban same-sex marriage than there was in 2004. According to one report by the Pew Research Center, 51% currently oppose the civil recognition of same-sex marriages, and that's a dramatic change from the 63% who were against it in 2004.
Right. This is unlike the abortion debate, where opinion has been pretty stable. This is a really shifting landscape. With each year, we see more and more support for gay rights and civil unions and gay marriage. And So if you're looking at the long term for the Republican Party, they might be on the wrong side of history, but you know they've got a fall election to worry about, so that's where their focus is.
In fact, some of the supporters of same-sex marriage are saying the more Americans meet these couples who are married, the more they're likely to change their minds. Again, with the Pew Center poll, the percentage of Americans in favor of same-sex marriage has increased greatly from 29% to 39%, and that's, again, over the course of a year. But still, that's not probably as high as some backers of same-sex marriage would like to see it. Linda Feldman, real quick, how do you see this playing out this week? Do you see it just kind of petering out?
Yes, I think, you know, we'll see the debate, we'll see members going on the record one way or the other, and then it will lose, and it will go away, but it'll go back sort of under the radar. It won't really go away, and we will have some initiatives at the state level as well. We have state court cases like New York State, which could go the way of Massachusetts. So the issue will remain alive. I don't think it will remain alive, though, in the Washington context.
Linda Feldman, White House correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor. Linda, thanks for speaking with us.
Great. Thank you, Robin.
Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas is raising the stakes in a dispute with the militant group Hamas. He says he won't accept any changes to a proposal calling for a two-state solution with Israel. Abbas, who leads the more moderate Fatah faction, has given Hamas, which controls parliament, until tomorrow to accept the proposal or face a national referendum on the issue. The proposal calls for the establishment of a Palestinian state, implying recognition of Israel across the border, recognition which Hamas refuses to grant. Well, we're going to spend a few minutes today on a personal story that underscores that conflict. It's the story of a Jewish girl named Dalia and a Palestinian named Bashir. In 1948, Bashir and his family fled their home in Al-Ramla after the war the Israelis called the War for Independence, the Palestinians called the Catastrophe. In 1967, Bashir returned to the home after the 1967 war. When Bashir and his two Palestinian cousins knock on the wrought iron gate, the door is opened by Dalia, the 19-year-old daughter of Bulgarian Holocaust survivors. She grew up in that house, believing that it had been abandoned willingly by the previous owners.
As soon as I saw them, she remembered, I felt, wow, it's them. It was as if I'd always been waiting for them. Now the youngest one, the one with a thin face and large brown eyes, opened his mouth. This was my father's house, said the young man in his halting English, and I lived here too. Dalia was ready for what came next. Would it be possible, the young man said, for us to come in and see the house? Dalia Ashkenazi knew she had very little time to process this question and respond. Logic dictated she tell the men to come back when her parents were home. If she allowed them to come in, what would that be inviting?
Well, when Dalia let Bashir in, she also opened the door to a tumultuous 40-year friendship. Journalist Sandy Tolan first produced a radio documentary for NPR on the real-life story of Dalia and Bashir. Now he's written a book, The Lemon Tree, a powerful account of the relationship between the two, but also a detailed history of Palestinians and Jews, starting with the British occupation of Palestine at the turn of the last century, through the world's decision in the form of a UN vote in 1947 to split Palestine and give Jews and Palestinians side-by-side states, up to the recent intifadas. Through Dalia and Bashir, we hear the voices of two peoples. One thinks they won the right to a state through a UN mandate and victory in wars. The other thinks their land was taken. And Sandy joins us from the studios of Wisconsin Public Radio. Sandy, thanks so much for being here. Welcome.
It's great to be here, Robin. Thanks.
Boy, what a book. Tell us the history of these two families. Dalia's came from Bulgaria?
That's right. She arrived with her parents as an infant in 1948 at the port of Haifa in the new, at the time, the new Israeli state. Her family had survived the Holocaust along with all of the other Bulgarian Jews. They were the only European Jewish community to remain intact because of the actions of some extraordinarily courageous people, both Jews and non-Jews, who acted really at a moment when literally there were train cars in one of the Bulgarian towns waiting to take the Jews to Treblinka. And as a result, Dahlia was born several years later. Her parents survived, and they made the decision, along with 90% of the other Bulgarian Jews, to live in the new Jewish state.
Tell us about Bashir's family. They lived in Al Ramla, and you remind us again of the history of this area, that after 1917, they were under the rule of the British just after the Balfour Declaration, in which England pledged to help Jews establish a homeland in Palestine. And at that time, members of this family there, you know, generations back, Arabs and Jews were living together.
There were pretty warm relations, a lot of coexistence. But as the 1930s came and as the situation for Jews deteriorated, to say the least, in Europe, more and more Jews were coming. And Arabs at first had welcomed them to a certain extent, but as more and more came, they said, well, you know, this is our home. We don't want a separate Jewish state.
Tensions rise. The UN proposes a two-state solution in 1947, and ironically, Bashir's home would have fallen in the Palestinian portion. But war breaks out. Jews call it the War of Independence. Arabs call it the Catastrophe. And it was a catastrophe for Bashir. The triumphant Jews take over several towns, including his, and he's moved out of his home.
For Bashir's family, there was nothing really, in a sense, in the early days, in the streets, people sleeping in orchards and barnyards, you know, lining up for relief supplied by countries around the world and the king of then Transjordan, before it was Jordan. They were desperate for one thing more than food and sustenance and shelter. They were desperate simply to return home.
You remind us, too, in the book of just how much other Arab countries failed the Palestinians.
There's an idea that all of the Arab countries were unified in their desire to annihilate Israel. And the history is more complex and more interesting. The Palestinian Arabs felt that the Arab countries did not sufficiently defend them. So Bashir and his family often felt betrayed by their fellow Arabs, for sure.
We move up to 1967, the 67 war, during which Israel annexed the West Bank, Gaza, the Golan Heights. But in another irony, Palestinians could now cross a different border. And so Bashir decides to go to his old home, 19 years after he lived there. We heard in the introduction the moment when Dahlia and Bashir saw each other at the door. But what happened during that meeting?
Bashir almost didn't believe his ears when Dahlia said, yes, please come in. And she smiled and opened the gate, and he and his cousins walked up the path. You know, she just watched them walk around, and she said, you know, it was like they were in a temple. And Bashir said, you know, in his memoir said, it was like I was in a mosque. It was like I was a holy man. He was drifting around. And then they came out to the lemon tree. And the lemon tree was a symbol. Bashir's father built that house in 1936. It was an act of faith that he planted this lemon tree, because lemon trees don't bear fruit for years.
Who is Dahlia at this point in the story? What was she thinking? What did she think about Israel?
Well, she's very much a loyal Israeli, an ardent Zionist. She believes in Israel. She loves her country. At the same time, she has this remarkable empathy. You know, she was a survivor of the Holocaust, but not in the way that others were, because her family and all the other Bulgarian Jews remained intact during the Holocaust. And she developed empathy for those who suffered beyond her experience.
That's Sandy Tolan, author of the new book, The Lemon Tree, An Arab, A Jew, and the Heart of the Middle East. Dahlia supports the Jewish people who've been expelled from so many countries and finally found a home, but she starts to understand that her home had belonged to another. We'll hear how her story carries on when we come back. Lemon Tree, which chronicles the complex relationship between a Palestinian man and the Israeli woman whose family moved into the house the Palestinian was expelled from in the 1948 war. And Sandy, you were just telling us about how Dahlia had come to question some of the beliefs she grew up with, including the idea that the Arabs left her village voluntarily. But as if this relationship isn't complicated enough, Bashir, the Palestinian, is soon revealed to be at least an activist and perhaps a terrorist. He's jailed for one of the first major terrorist bombings in the State of Israel. This took place in 1969. So, first of all, do you think Bashir was responsible for the 1969 bombing of the Super Soul store in Jerusalem?
According to the Israelis and according to the court, and according to Dahlia's belief, He did. According to Bashir, he did not. Now, he believes in the right of return, and he said sometimes in the past the methods were violent, and I understood them, he told me. And I know that he spent 15 years in prison.
And when Bashir is jailed, this comes at a time of bombings, hijackings, all those plane hijackings, the Munich Olympic massacre. And Dalia feels betrayed by this person she thought she knew and was at least getting to know better.
She cut off all contact as soon as the conviction came and didn't speak for many years. Bashir in prison used to occasionally speak about this Israeli woman who's unlike the other Israelis, and people would say all Israelis are alike. He said, no, there's one at least who's different, who understands.
Well, meanwhile, as Bashir is in prison and Dalia's trying to figure out what it all means, she still opens her home to Bashir's family. They come to see the house they once lived in. Bashir's father, Ahmed, returns after 22 years, after he lived in it. And he meets Dalia's father, Moshe, at the threshold. Could you read to us that encounter?
The two men stood facing each other across the threshold, Ahmed and Moshe, two fathers of the same house. There was a lemon tree here, Ahmed said to Moshe. I planted it. Is it still here? Is it still alive? Nuha and Moshe rose and stood on either side of Ahmed. They led him slowly to the corner of the garden. Ahmed extended his arms, running his fingers up the smooth, hard bark, over the soft knobs on the tree's base. Zakiya watched from the table in silence, tears in her eyes.
Sandy Tolan, the lemon tree and the lemon became something that, Bashir and Dalia didn't see the same way. And for Bashir, that was very telling. You know, he told her what? You see it as a lemon, I see it as what?
I see it as Palestine. I see it as our right, our birthright, our land. I think it's one of the things that's been most underestimated throughout the entire history of this conflict is the Palestinian attachment to land in exile.
Well, Dalia was beginning to understand that hers was a house with two histories, while still fiercely believing that Israel won the wars and the right to have a Jewish state. This brings us to the late 80s, the first Intifada, Dalia bedridden with cancer and a pregnancy. She decides to write a letter to the paper. This really rocks Israel because she tells other Israelis of her sympathy for the plight of the Palestinians, while also being pretty angry about the Intifada. Could you set the scene for us?
Bashir was just on the eve of being deported, suspected after several years after his release from prison of being one of the organizers of the Intifada, the uprising which erupted in the Palestinian occupied territories. She felt that it was not right to deport Bashir, and so she wrote an open letter that was published in the Jerusalem Post. It was an open letter to Bashir. Ever since I met you, the feeling has been growing in me that home was not just my home. The lemon tree, which yielded so much fruit and gave us so much delight, lived in other people's hearts, too. The spacious house, with its high ceilings, big windows, and large grounds, was no longer just an Arab house. It had faces behind it now. The walls evoked other people's memories and tears.
She also goes on to say later in the letter, if you could disassociate yourself from your past terrorist actions, your commitment to your own people would gain true moral force in my eyes. In other words, she's got conflicting feelings about Bashir. He doesn't respond for quite a long time because of different events, but he does ultimately write her a letter. What does he say back?
For one thing, he objects to her characterizing any of his actions as terrorist. And then he reveals something to her that she had no idea of for all these years. The family was in Gaza late in 1948, shortly after arriving from Ramallah, and that he and his sister and other brothers and sisters had been playing in the dirt outside their cement block house, and that they saw something gleaming in the sun, something bulbous with a wick protruding, looked like a lantern. Then he then writes to her, the booby-trapped toy exploded in my left hand to crush my palm, to scatter my bones and flesh, and shed my blood to blend it with the soil of Palestine.
Which is why when we see him throughout the book, his hand is always in a pocket, and she never even knew why he had one hand in a pocket, and that's why.
And neither did I when I neither did I when I interviewed him for months.
Well, Sandy Tolan, it's not a Hollywood ending. Dalia holds to the belief that if Bashir is allowed his right of return, if Palestinians are allowed their right of return, there will be no more of her beloved Israel. He, Bashir, does not want a two-state solution. It seems so intractable. And yet there is some optimism in that Dalia actually turns over the house to something, I don't know, that would ultimately bring the two people together.
Her parents had died, the house was empty, and she just didn't feel comfortable selling it. She said, you know, I could sell it and give the proceeds to your family. And he said, no way. You know, our patrimony is not for sale. And she said, well then what do you want to do? And he said, well, I lost my childhood in that house. And so I'd like you to have it be a kindergarten for the Arab children who live now in Ramla. And she agreed to do that. And then she and her husband wanted to turn it into a center for encounter between Arab and Jew, and that's what they did. But what's amazing to me, and I was able to witness in late 2004, they actually met again. They hadn't seen each other in probably, maybe 10 years. And we got to Ramallah, and they shook hands for what, it seemed like 10 minutes, and just smiling at each other and beaming at each other. And this is this point where, as Dalia says, we're not friends in that traditional sense. Friends choose each other. We're connected by history in a way that neither can wish the other away.
Sandy Tolan, author of The Lemon Tree, An Arab, A Jew, and the Heart of the Middle East. He's speaking to us from Wisconsin Public Radio. Stay with us. Much more ahead, here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from WBUR Boston.
Security Council is making a first-ever trip to Sudan this week. The UN wants to convince the Sudanese government to allow UN peacekeepers into Darfur, where government-backed Arab militias, known as the Janjaweed, have been waging what the U.S. has called genocide since 2003. While the focus in Sudan is now on the war in the western part of the country, Sudan's 21-year bloody civil war in the south also claimed 2 million lives. The UN brokered a peace deal in the south last year, and now people are finally returning home, including some of the Lost Boys, a group of 20,000 children and young men who escaped the villages of southern Sudan and fled on foot to Ethiopia and then a refugee camp in Kenya. About 3,800 Lost Boys were allowed into the U.S. in 2001. 29-year-old Panther Alir was one of them. This weekend, he graduated from the University of Massachusetts Boston with a degree in political science, and he joins us in the studio. Welcome and congratulations.
Thank you.
The government in Khartoum will be negotiating with the UN Security Council this week to bring the UN troops to Darfur, as we said. This is the same government that waged the civil war in the south of Sudan, where you lived. It was a religious, primarily a religious civil war between Christians and Arabs. Do you have faith that this same government is going to be able to, work with the Security Council to bring peace to Darfur?
Not really. I mean, the northern government have had history of not really living up to their promise. You can clearly see from how sometimes they seem to be leaning toward accepting UN forces, and sometimes they, make another contradicting point. Mm. So I really can't say I have faith whatsoever.
It's really not that long ago that you had to flee your village in southern Sudan. Your village was attacked. Your parents died.
Well, it was very drastic, very sudden, in a sense, because the first time I found myself by myself alone and with no people who are related to me, it just felt really terrible. And
The West began hearing these stories of thousands of children and young men walking. What was that like to be walking along with thousands of young boys, many of them dying as you walked?
It was so sad. You walk in, you see somebody remaining behind, and you think, that person is going to rise up and follow you, but that was not true, People would fall down because, of thirst. You just see your friend left behind, and that was it.
How do you shake that off in a way
and suddenly find yourself in college in America, you know, grappling with studying for 4 years. Where do you put that? What happened? That walk? You just put it in a compartment in the back of your head somewhere, or how do you do that?
Oh, it's a difficult situation. You know, I have a strategy that I think I'm looking forward to the future would actually help me than always reflect back on what happened because I see it as really damaging to be thinking about, you know, what had happened in the past because it's too emotional that I just think, you know, I need to make my life, and looking forward to the future would help.
I understand that you went to UMass Boston as part of a program where students were allowed in who didn't really have the grades, perhaps, but had the potential. How much did you feel the need to prove that potential when you were at school?
It was, you know, first of all, when I decided to go to college here, it was a little bit intimidating because I never went to school in a Western learning setting. So I knew it was going to be challenging, and I applied, and they saw my potential, and they gave me a chance to try and to prove that I have a potential. And, of course, I did that. I just, you know, I kept focusing on my work. I seek help, and that helped me.
Well, what do you want to do? As we said, many refugees are returning to the south of Sudan. Do you want to go back?
That would be really nice thing to do if the condition allows me to. I think I have gotten a skill that would be more useful to apply in the South. But if the situation, as far as my own life is concerned, doesn't allow me to go back to the South, I would always want to work for UN, either in peace building or humanitarian work. And, you know, these are the things that, but the priority is to go back to South and help.
What was your first impression of the U.S. when you came here? And how do you feel about possibly leaving it now?
When I came to the U.S., it was totally different. Everything about U.S. was different because I lived in a camp that was, you know, almost nothing there except just human being and the land. But here you see almost anything. So it was quite overwhelming to actually see myself fit into the life here. But now, you know, I have lived here for 5 years, and I have seen the beauty of this land. If I were to go back completely, it would be really difficult. But if I went back with a good objective, that is to help people back home, I would.
You could go back to Sudan and make it better.
Make it better.
I'm thinking, though, that when you were at school and just, you know, moving around, meeting Americans, you all of you, Lost Boys, you organized the first National Convention of Lost Boys and Girls of Sudan in Arizona last year. One of the things you must talk about, you must think Americans are a bunch of whiners. You must think, you know, these people don't know how good they have it. You know, they complain about things. They don't know. They haven't seen anything. Come on, do you ever say that?
Well, sometimes I do say that some people take things that are here for granted. And when I speak to young children here, I always tell them that you have the privilege that you should never take for granted, because there are other children of your age that are actually suffering.
With what you've learned, how would you solve the situation in Darfur? What would you do?
I would not always seek permission from the government that is actually part of the campaign. I mean, there's no way I would expect them to cooperate with me when they are actually the perpetrators of the incident.
Panther Alyer, he was graduated from the University of Massachusetts Boston with a degree in political science.
Yep.
Right. This past weekend, he is one of the lost boys and girls from Sudan. who fled his village during that country's civil war. Panther, best of luck to you and congratulations again.
Thank you, Robert.
And still to come, you thought it was about sport. To many European fans, soccer is about World War II, and this year the fact that the World Cup is in Germany is posing some problems. That's coming up. You're listening to Here and Now. An Iowa treasure. That's what Governor Tom Vilsack called Des Moines Register columnist Rob Borsellino, who was laid to rest on Saturday. A transplanted New Yorker, Rob became a beloved celebrity in Des Moines because, in the words of one of his colleagues, he was a wiseacre who had a heart, who offered a fresh and fair take on life in the Midwest. For instance, he once wrote that since moving to Iowa, it had been years since he'd given anyone the finger. Well, Rob also gave his readers permission to share laughs about his personal struggle with ALS, also known as Lou Gehrig's disease. We spoke with Rob last year, right after he disclosed that he had ALS. We asked him then, why go public?
Well, it's getting out there. I should point out that, I mean, Des Moines is a relatively small community. I've got an extremely high profile. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm this guy from the Bronx who moved to Iowa and writes for the paper and all this. Mm. And people were hearing about it and talking about it and approaching me about it. And that was one big thing. The other thing is, as you can probably hear, my voice mm-hmm. is a mess. Mm. And having to explain to everybody, I'm sober. It's just that I've got, Lou Gehrig's disease. That's why I sound like this. Mm-hmm. And it was getting to the point where I just wanted to get it out there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But you write that you were in denial of some of those bigger issues.
To some extent, I still am. I can still drive. I can still go to work in the morning. So it's not like I'm at the point where I've got to deal with it 24/7 because I don't.
Well, for instance, you write one of the questions you're ignoring is, "Do I want to live strapped up to some breathing machine and a voice box?"
Yeah, my visceral response to that is no. If I can't function, if I can't have a decent life, then I don't want to live. That's my visceral response. Who the hell knows, a year from now.
Well, Rob, I'm wondering, when do you think you might take some legal precautions and what might you do to make sure you don't end up in the middle of a court battle or, maybe a fight?
I've already dealt with that. I went to see an attorney and gave my wife power to make that decision. Understanding how I feel, she'll take care of it.
Do you have thoughts about how you'd feel if your wife, as healthcare proxy, if her feelings were overturned by a doctor?
Well, that would really that's something that would really anger me, even just thinking about it.
Yeah. Well, your in-laws held a prayer service at a Sikh temple in New Delhi. You've got friends checking out stem cell research in Beijing online. A lot of people pulling for you.
Well, what's interesting, too, that it opens your eyes to something like stem cell research. People from Iowa are going to Beijing to get help for MS and Lou Gehrig's disease and a whole bunch of other stuff.
Well, Rob Borsellino, I know you've made a decision that you now have a lot to say about this subject, and I'm looking forward to reading it. Thanks so much.
Well, thank you, Rob. It was good talking to you.
That's Des Moines Register columnist Rob Borsellino speaking to us in February of 2005. His wife says that Rob's wishes were carried out. In early May, he typed his final column with one finger. He died in hospice on May 27th at the age of 56. Stay with us. Much more ahead here and now. whistle blows to begin the first match of the 2006 Men's Soccer World Cup in Germany. Over the next 4 weeks, 32 nations will compete for the coveted title of World Cup champion. Soccer experts say Brazil, the 2002 World Cup champion, is the team to beat. But the joy that accompanies this once-every-four-year event threatens to be overshadowed by issues of race and politics. Black players are reportedly being told not to wander into neo-Nazi neighborhoods. There have been reports of a surge of racist insults being directed at black players during games all over Europe. And English fans are being advised it's against the law to make a mock Nazi salute in Germany. And everyone is worried about whether the president of Iran, an avid soccer fan and Holocaust denier, will show up to root for his team. Seamus Mullen is soccer analyst for ESPN. He joins us in the studio. And Seamus, the World Cup is about sports, but it is always about so much more.
It really is. You know, it's the meeting place for the world in the greatest game, they feel, and certainly in the game that's so much more, the most popular game around the world. But it's impossible for that to exist outside the realm of politics and social behavior. And there are some subliminal issues that are coming now to the surface that are somewhat troublesome, but I think the authorities feel they've got to get out in the open and get a handle on quickly.
Well, we understand that, for instance, in England, they're giving these, you know, sort of workshops to soccer fans so they know how to behave in Germany. One fan club website says soccer has a nasty habit of mixing up events off the pitch with events on the pitch. And we understand that English fans in particular bring World War II into their fights with Germany, into their games with Germany.
They do that, and they've been asked, as you say, emphatically not to do it. The worst example was in the European Championship in 1996, which was hosted by England, and the tabloids were absolutely irresponsible that time in fanning the flames of the memories of the war. It was really pretty shocking and disgraceful. They have issued warnings not to intimidate and not to insult German fans. It's also true that this exists in Holland. It's not just in the UK. And the Dutch have asked their fans not to go and carry with them, as they were somewhere planning to, these orange helmets — orange is their color — helmets that were mock-ups of the old German World War II helmet, as just kind of an insult to the Germans, with whom they have a deep and bitter rivalry on the sports field.
Well, it'll be interesting to see, even with those warnings, if the fans, and particularly the English fans, refrain from doing what they apparently do at Germany-England matches outside of the World Cup. They apparently do things like sing songs with hand gestures about English flyers shooting down Germans. And a favorite shout, apparently, is "Stand up if you won the war."
Yes, so, right.
We'll see if that happens.
It is "stand up," by the way, is a very typical crowd cry in Britain. So that if you go to a soccer match, even just a club match, at some point or another, each of the set of fans will sing that out. For instance, if you're a Chelsea fan, at a Chelsea game away from home, the crowd that goes will say, "Stand up if you're a Chelsea fan." And that means that people literally get off their seats and stand for a while to show that kind of loyalty, which annoys the heck out of all the other people around them who want to sit down and watch the game in comfort.
Well, the game, by the way, we should probably
talk about that.
There's a saying we hear about soccer: the English invented it, the Brazilians perfected it. The Brazilians seem pretty perfect. Is that one way of looking at this? I mean, going in?
Perfection is a dodgy word to be throwing around. Certainly Brazil are the odds-on favorite. Certainly they have the most exciting group of players in a while. They are favorites, I think, primarily because people see where the goals will come from. In a sport where goals are hard to score, the Brazilians have the talent all over the place to score goals. And while there is some doubt here and there about the quality of their defending, the feeling is that even if they give up a goal or two, they'll go to the other end and score three or four.
Who are the other teams that pose a threat?
Their fellow South American rival, their bitterest rival, Argentina, are going to be very, very strong. A lot of people feel that England are going to have a good run because it's the best squad they've had in a while. But they have a way of shooting themselves in the foot, to use an unfortunate metaphor for soccer. But I think Holland is a bit of a dark horse. People are not expecting them to do that well, but I think they have a new manager who's going to make a big difference for them. And then maybe finally, this is Spain's year. People have been saying that World Cup after World Cup after World Cup. They have wonderful players. They always underachieve, and maybe this is the year. And my fifth one, I think, is Italy typically has a terrible start. Everybody writes them off, and then you look around, and they're in the Final Four.
Well, there's a team you haven't mentioned. I can't help but note. It's the U.S.
Yes.
What are the chances of the U.S. team, and who are some of the players who've made a name for themselves?
Mm-hmm. Well, the U.S. chances of winning the World Cup are very slim. I mean, let's be very candid about that, as are the chances for about 26 of the teams going.
Right.
So there's no disgrace in saying you're not going to win it. And most teams will say, we're going to go as far as we can go. Brazil is a team that says, we think we can win it.
Right.
So the U.S. has got better and better and better and is now a respected nation and therefore will be a threat, primarily because they've got some very good players going forward. Landon Donovan is a great revelation for the team as a scorer. We have terrific goalkeeping in Casey Keller, and that very often is the difference between advancing or not advancing. But more than anything else, this is a team that is incredibly well-trained. They're very fit, and they are no longer a team that can be taken for granted by the opposition in Europe.
I want to ask you about another headline about another team, Italy. I mean, apparently there's a huge scandal in Italy about match-fixing, club owners choosing the referees for games, misplaced funds. What's going on there?
There is a burgeoning crisis in Italy, and it could finally be the one that exposes a lot of what people have suspected has been going on in Italy for quite some time, unfortunately. And that is for paying of referees and for fiddling games and so forth. This is really big, and this could finally blow the bubble and for once and forever, perhaps, put an end to the culture of conspiracy which surrounds the game in Italy and which would be a great blessing for Italian fans, players, and the world game, really.
Mm. Every tournament, Seamus, there's a team that, you know, comes from behind. In 2002, South Korea made it all the way to the semifinals. I remember the fans. They had these red T-shirts and they were banging on drums. Who do you think the sleeper is this year?
That's a great question. I think the big question this year is who from Africa is going to be a bit of a shock, because there are three surprise teams coming in from Africa this year. Ivory Coast, Togo, Angola are the three surprises. I think Ivory Coast has a real shot to surprise people. And then I said the Netherlands. I think the Netherlands wouldn't be a surprise if they do well, but if they get to the final four or two, it would be a big surprise, but not to me. I think they're a team with a lot going for them.
So, Seamus, what do you think? Do you think at the end of this World Cup, this will be the World Cup where Americans might actually start calling the sport football?
You talked about perfectionism and miracles. That's not going to happen. But I think it's safe to say this, that America is now a soccer-playing country. We have been in the World Cup since 1990. We have the only coach coming back for the second consecutive World Cups. We have players playing in Europe. We have now a reputation in the world which is not one of taking us for granted, as was the case 4 years ago when Portugal were very arrogant and disrespectful and got beaten by the United States. That will not happen. There will not be disrespect this time. There will be a lot of respect, a lot of apprehension, perhaps even tinged with fear that the U.S. is here. Now, we just have to persuade our own population that that is the case. A huge part of it knows it. The ethnic piece of America knows very well where the United States has gone. A lot of the suburban people also know who've been involved in the game as organizers and who've played. But the great numbers of people in the sporting public at large in America, more and more are coming on board, and I think this could be a breakthrough year.
Seamus Mellon of ESPN, do not call him over the next 4 weeks because he's busy. Seamus, thanks so much.
My pleasure.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news and the